Thank you very much, Walter, for that provocative introduction. I'm afraid I don't have time to explain it fully, but of course, as you know about most pilots, they'd be happy to talk about flying at any time in the halls or elsewhere. We do at Vanderbilt, as you do at Cornell, treasure teaching. We treasure learning. We have a number of programs to honor and improve undergraduate teaching at Vanderbilt, and one of those is a series that I started a dozen years ago. It's the Chancellor's Lecture Series on Great Teaching. We invite people who are distinguished teachers at undergraduate institutions, graduate institutions as well, around the United States to come to Vanderbilt and talk about how they teach. And one of the early people that we discovered and invited to Vanderbilt to tell us about teaching was Walter Lefebvre. As you probably know, he is a master of teaching large collections of engaging, holding, and teaching large collections of people, and we were privileged to have him in our presence. Let me explain further that my connection here with Dale Corzine is I am his successor's successor as the chairman of the Government University Industry Research Roundtable. This is an organization that, as the name implies, joins leadership from the university sector, the industrial sector, and the government sector relating to research issues. It meets under the auspices of the National Academy of Science with the enthusiastic participation of the presidents of the National Academy of Science, the National Academy of Engineering, and the Institute of Medicine. I might say that this is a very interesting organization. I will say a word or two about it in a moment, but I want to take a bit of time to sort of connect some of the questions that Charlotte raised and some of the issues that were raised by speakers earlier this morning. It is a pleasure to talk about the future of research universities. Most university presidents are mired in the present, with issues that come up that cannot be delegated, must be decided. Some of them relate to the future and some do not. One would conclude that a good part of life around a university might deal with the past rather than the future, except for its students. As a person who has spent a career in the computer field, now it's coming to light that the computer field is influencing everything. Of course, those of us in computer science have known that all along. It's just a matter of when, not whether. I might make this observation that at universities, we are particularly adept at creating change, at discovering new knowledge that causes change, and teaching others to change. But I must also say that we are loath to change ourselves. It was once said that if your great-great-grandparents came back to visit, where might they feel most comfortable, where things have changed the least? And the answer was in any college or school classroom. Pretty much looks the same. Now, we want to maintain what we value and what we have held for the past. We must engage the future because now we are exposed to more and more forces outside of our own control. This issue is one that is, I believe, going to engage this presidential election, perhaps more than we might even think now. I'll make that prediction here. We'll see how it plays out. But I think education, change, the global economy that you heard described this morning will become very, very active issues as this campaign progresses. And so I want to use a quotation from a former presidential candidate, and I quote, "Neither a wise man nor a brave man," he said, "lies down on the tracks of history to wait for the train of the future to run over him." That candidate was Dwight Eisenhower. He spoke those words during the presidential campaign some 47 years ago, but if anything, the advice is perhaps more appropriate today. We have to look forward, and we need to act on what we see. Otherwise, we do indeed run the risk of getting literally run over by the express train of global change stimulated by information technology and other forces. I've been asked to address this nexus between these three sectors, something that's very comfortable to me. My early career and working my way through college, I made 50 cents an hour, Dale, and not 30. I worked in a grocery store, and it paid more than grading math papers, and so that's how I made my decision. But when I got into legitimate work in the computer field, I went into the private sector, because actually at that time, this was in the middle 1950s, that's where the more interesting work was being done. I was sent off to MIT in the late 1950s as one of five people from the United States to help get out of the laboratory one of the items that Frank Press showed on his slide this morning, and that's the computer control of machines. There's some research going on there. We had the job of getting that out and making these machines actually work. So at least my own experience in this university-industry connection goes back that far. Not very heavily recognized then, but very much a connection. I have since been involved equally in the private sector as well as universities, and so the notion of the differences don't come through to me nearly as clearly as the similarities and the growing dependence. Now, this Government University Industry Research Roundtable, as conceived by Dale and perpetuated by others, serves as an advisor in an advisory, or actually I guess I should say, in the capacity of enlightenment on public policy. We do not give specific advice to government agencies, and that's because we are prohibited by law from doing so, since we have government representatives with us at the table. It is an organization that treats its choices of subjects carefully. There are many questions, many we do not cover. But I think today I would like to illustrate with an example or two and talk about why I think this is an important entity still and is one of Dale's more important contributions to the value of science research as it relates to our civilized society. I think it's very easy to make the case for strong communication and coordination between these sectors. I think that, just to give you an illustration of the membership of this group, we have, they won't allow more than about two university presidents in this group of 30. They're smart people. We have scientists, we have entrepreneurs. It ranges from Nobel laureates to actually Dean Kamen, who is a college dropout from Worcester Polytechnic Institute. Kamen is a billionaire. He has, I think, 200 patents at last count, mostly in medical devices. But more recently, you may have seen on some of the national news broadcasts a new wheelchair that Dean invented that can stand. It is actually has gyros installed in it to allow full vertical and horizontal mobility by those who use wheelchairs. The man is truly a genius. So we have all types of individuals there, and I would put in the middle, of course, vice presidents of research from several major corporations. We have a number of issues that we consider important, and let me just touch on a few of the linkages. Just last week, the Association of University Technology Managers, an organization called AUTUM, found that at least 280,000 jobs and $34 billion in economic activity is directly attributable to university-based research, directly attributable. Indirect attributions, you saw from the press slide, go well beyond that. In fact, the longstanding policy that created this national science research system recognized the importance of these intersections and established national laboratories, some of them are allowed by virtue of the tax laws. Some are enabled by appropriations to special parts of the government, the Department of Energy, for example. But the spectrum of these facilities is full and complete. This approach, this business of a full spectrum of research activity ranging from universities to industrial laboratories to government laboratories, then to industry, is one of the recognized great strengths of the country. You heard some data on it this morning. Let me just give you another quote or two. David Gergen in the U.S. News and World Report recently said, "Washington needs to wake up. Just as the patrons of Renaissance Italy supported artists, statesmen today should support scientists and engineers." Alan Bromley, writing in the Washington Post, Alan's former president science advisor, said, and I quote, "America's on a roll. We're balancing the federal budget, reforming welfare, and making retirement secure. Sound like a breakthrough in fiscal management? Not exactly. Our awesome economic success can be traced directly to our past investments in science." George Mellowen, writing in the Wall Street Journal, and I quote him, "All this new science just didn't happen. It had to be incubated. If the United States can preserve the environment that hatches inventions, it can look forward with optimism to the 21st century." All of this attention is very nice, but in today's world, if you stop long enough to pat yourself on the back, you risk missing the next half dozen developments. So in keeping with the theme of the future of research universities, of looking forward and taking action, I want to suggest three key areas where new thinking and approaches may be needed. They're examples of areas that will require substantial attention if we want to continue strengthening the partnership among research universities, the federal government, and private industry, and if we hope to sustain the advances that are driving our global economy. The first is, for lack of a better term, interconnectedness. This mind-numbing term and others like it, words like multidisciplinary, interdisciplinary, cross-cutting, all reflect the reality that much of today's best research is happening at the intersection of disciplines. Today, science and technology don't fit in neat little boxes that reflect long-standing organizational charts, whether they're used by campus administrators, federal bureaucrats, or corporate CEOs. Last June, the Government Research Roundtable held its first ever quarterly meeting outside the nation's capital. We did so deliberately. We wanted to get outside the Beltway to look at the degree, and there's much evidence that it's very substantial, to which research universities do serve as catalysts for regional high-tech development and innovation. So we chose a relatively new stronghold of this phenomenon. The meeting was hosted by the University of California, San Diego, a location that is exploding as a result of this interconnection between universities and industry. It is especially exploding in the area of biomedical and information technology areas. It is sort of the incubator for wireless communication among in the communications area. This whole phenomenon has occurred in about the last dozen years. So it is much younger, much newer, and happening much more rapidly than Route 128, Silicon Valley, Research Triangle Park, and some of the other illustrations. One of the buzzwords at this meeting was bioinformatics, or as one UCSD researcher called it, silicobiology. It represents a merger born of necessity, as Charlotte mentioned earlier, between information technology and the biomedical world, and undoubtedly is spawning a new breed of highly skilled researchers to meet the demands of a burgeoning industry. We at Vanderbilt established a Department of Bioinformatics about 10 years ago in the medical school, actually, although it's a university-wide area, and in fact, it is indeed burgeoning. As these secrets, say in the human genome, Charlotte mentioned, are unlocked, literally mountains of data are coming out that are only meaningful when they can be organized and connected and made available by means of information technology. And this is revolutionizing biology and its teaching, even in the earliest years. So this is not a small job, neither at the research end or at the education end or at the application end. It is a job for biologists with solid grounding in information technology and related fields. No computer wizard alone, no biologist alone can accomplish this. It takes teams, these interdisciplinary teams. This is relatively common knowledge in a whole host of disciplines, but it is one that is causing a number of frictions and tensions in academia and not just. Interconnectedness also reflects the fact that many of today's exciting biomedical and technological breakthroughs are built on the underpinnings of basic research accomplished in the physical sciences. Hal Varmus, who is a regular member of our group, and until recently the director of the National Institutes of Health, summed up the relationships in the following way, and I quote Hal. Most of the revolutionary changes that have occurred in biology and medicine are rooted in new method, he says. Those in turn are usually rooted in fundamental discoveries in many different fields. Some of these are so obvious that we lose sight of them, like the role of nuclear physics in producing the radioisotopes essential for most modern medical science. Physics also supplied the ingredients fundamental to many common critical practices, clinical practices, x-rays, CAT scans, fiber optic viewing, laser surgery, echocardiography, and fetal sonograms. Material science is helping with new joints, heart valves, and other tissue mimetics. These are but a few of many examples of the dependence of biomedical sciences on a wide range of disciplines. Physics, chemistry, engineering, and many allied fields. These examples underscore the need to sustain the strength of our science across the full spectrum. And I would point out that the distance sometimes is rather large. I believe nuclear magnetic resonance was discovered in 1946, mid-40s. But until the large-scale, high-speed computer came along to enable that technology, we could not do NMR imaging as we do today. So many of the gaps between basic discovery and actual use are more than a trivial number of years. What needs to be done in order to accelerate this? I think there are two or three that I would like to leave with you. Universities need to encourage, recognize, and reward faculty members who want to work in these promising new areas. Their career shouldn't suffer. They should not be penalized in promotion, renewal, and tenure, in other words, for stepping outside the traditional confines of their departments to work in these new intersections with other departments or schools. I might say in the 18 years that I have been the chancellor at Vanderbilt, we have changed the rules for appointments, renewal, and tenure at Vanderbilt two times. Major undertakings, major committees, took 3 or 4 years each time to try to move closer to these objectives. This is not easy work, but it is, I believe, essential work. Meanwhile, second, policymakers in Congress and the White House need to provide stable research funding for all scientific disciplines. This, by extension, means smoothing out the uneven stop-and-go patterns of funding for the various agencies that provide grants for university-based research, patterns often based more on political considerations and the current popularity of some types of research than on an awareness of how the various disciplines interact. You heard a good deal about that this morning. It is a recognized problem. Getting to the solution to that problem is something that we hope to address in GUIRR and is certainly going to take enlightened work from members of the Congress and government like Congressman Ehlers, Senator Frist, who has not been mentioned yet, but who is on the Senate side helping a good deal with science policy. Biomedical research has enjoyed substantial and well-deserved budget increases over the last couple of years. That was described also. But other disciplines haven't fared nearly so well. A recent report sponsored by the National Research Council, according to that report, has found in recent years federal support for such research areas as physics, mechanical engineering, electrical engineering, and the geological sciences has actually dropped substantially. That needs to be corrected. The second major area I want to touch on is our education system itself. It's a large topic, but I want to touch briefly on a couple of aspects particularly germane to today's discussion, I think. First, the quality of American education is of great concern, not only to those of us in academia and to all levels of government with responsibilities in this area, but also to the leaders of our high-tech industries. They need skilled workers to handle the complex demands of a workplace fueled by the rapid advancement of technical knowledge. In some high-tech industries, in some locations, it's a near-term problem, and it's being addressed with temporary fixes that allow them to make do. Raising immigration quotas. You heard the numbers this morning. Hundreds of thousands coming in because we cannot supply the workforce necessary from our own educational system. And the high-tech CEOs know that it's a bigger and more dangerous problem in the long run than in the short. And they worry that this country's educational system will not be able to meet their future demands for skilled workers. It's a bottom-line issue for them. It's a pipeline issue for them. Many know it's a problem that begins in the K-12 classroom. And in fact, the solutions they have in addition to raising immigration quotas, which is a very political issue in this country, is simply to locate their facilities outside this country, which is not exactly necessarily in the best interest of the United States. When one looks at the traditional composition of the country's science and technology professionals and then considers the nation's demographic trends, it's easy to conclude that you can't get there from here. Something has to change. The talent pool has to be expanded to include fast-growing segments of our population who previously have not been well represented in these fields. At our meeting in San Diego, we learned that many of the high-tech companies there are so aware of this problem of educational haves and have-nots that they are working diligently with the educational community to do something about it, and in fact have created a high-tech high school, a new tuition-free public charter school aimed at the diverse group of middle school students interested in math and science who are from impoverished backgrounds who otherwise would not get access to high-quality education. This links students with industry mentors. This is financed by industry. It sits on the campus of the University of California, San Diego. That is a manifestation of the level of interest and concern that these companies have and their university counterparts to this K-12 issue. In addition, more than 150 organizations in that area, including biomedical firms and high technology companies, along with government and university programs, have become involved in the San Diego Science Alliance. It's designed to identify and meet the needs of K-12 science teachers who seek to encourage students to consider science careers. This program draws heavily on business resources and features free 8-week seminars for science teachers, including site visits to science and technology-oriented companies and a telephone hotline that connects teachers with volunteer scientists and engineers. This includes volunteer scientists and engineers at the university as well as at the industrial companies. These types of initiatives are only a start, but they show the type of refreshing and innovating solutions that can be brought to bear jointly by industry and the education community. And having done a good deal of that at Vanderbilt, I can tell you that it is greeted with enthusiasm by volunteer faculty and by teachers in the community who desperately need and want some way to upgrade themselves professionally, as Charlotte has described. And while on the subject of educating America's youth, I want to interject here a note about the critical role played by our schools of education, the institutions that create the teachers, train the teachers, who prepare our children for this fast-changing world. This is an issue of great personal concern to me, not only because Vanderbilt has one of the better education schools in the nation, but also because I have long believed that those of us who accept the job of teaching the teachers have a special responsibility to do the job well. And let me just say that I went to Vanderbilt University as chancellor in 1982. Vanderbilt had merged with a bankrupt school of education, Peabody, 2 years prior. It had gone under financially. So one of the issues that I faced was what to do about that school. In evaluating it, it turned out to have one of the best reputations for teacher education in the world, but it was not able to sustain itself financially. I can say today that that school, that part, it is a school of Vanderbilt, just as is Arts and Science. It has a dean. It is in the black. It is going well. It is very, very much a leader in the kinds of changes that I think we need to see. And let me just mention that 6 weeks ago, the American Council on Education released the report of a task force that undertook a year-long evaluation of the way teachers are taught on U.S. campuses. I was a very interested and involved member of that task force, and I must tell you, the picture is not favorable. It found that the quality of schooling in America is inadequate for today's needs, and that strengthening teacher education is the key element in improving United States schools. Of particular interest to this audience, the report came down hard on the employment of unqualified teachers, which is especially prevalent in mathematics and science. We found that more than half, and that's kind, it's probably closer to 70 to 80% in most places, of United States students in grades 7 through 12 were taught by unqualified math and science teachers. That won't do. As one might expect, the figures are even higher for those impoverished inner city areas and rural areas. Among this report charges college presidents to step in and do something about it as a personal issue for the chief executive officer. And here are some of the recommendations. Ensure that teacher education programs have the resources to educate future teachers in the use of technology in teaching mathematics and science, particularly. Otherwise, technology will fail to meet its educational promise if we neglect to equip teachers with the skills they need to understand and use it. We now know that it does involve different ways of teaching and that people have to learn to do that. Second, require that education faculty and courses be coordinated with arts and science faculty and courses. And let me say, at Vanderbilt, we got a governor in years past to get legislation changed so that in order to be certified for secondary teaching in the state of Tennessee, a person has to have both an education major and a major in one of 17 arts and science disciplines, truly a double major, in order to teach at the secondary school level. A number of other states have done that. That is the kind of thing we think involvement by both arts and science faculty and education faculty means. Third, we need to make a greater investment in educational research, which lags well behind research in all the other national priorities, defense, health, agriculture, and energy. But there's one other ingredient, and that is the only professional schools that teachers have are education schools. And yet the research that education schools do is unread, not understandable by practicing teachers. Education research is almost totally disconnected from the practice. We wouldn't allow that in medicine. We couldn't. We won't allow it in law. We won't allow it in business. We must correct that connection for education research and the practice of teaching. The real bottom line is that colleges and universities with education schools should either make a commitment to do the job well and fill that commitment or get out of the business. They're doing more harm than good. The report put the onus squarely on college and university presidents. It emerged last week. I'm hopeful that it will have some impact, and I hope to have something to do with that impact. Talk of national interest leads me to the third and final area I want to address, and that is federal policy as it affects the overall climate for university research in the United States. I strongly believe that it has been and will continue to be in this country's best interest to make basic research one of its highest priorities. Ideally, it would be mentioned in the same breath with the national issues of education, which is an issue, a political issue if there ever was one, Social Security, same thing, and Medicare. We need to have research in that group of things that are highest priority for this nation. And it could be done. It could be done with some leadership that we can develop if we work hard and work with the members of the Congress and the administration that will help us do it. It's the only way it will happen. As I noted earlier, the United States has developed a unique system for conducting its scientific and engineering research. It relies extensively on a large and diverse array of research universities, laboratories, both public and private. The success of that system relies partly on the size and shape of annual appropriations by those agencies that fund research grants. But just as importantly, the success is based on national policies that foster an environment for robust activity in research, that is, indirect policies that have a profound effect other than just appropriations. Let me mention a couple. A conservative fiscal policy that has helped us reduce the federal deficit, stabilize monetary policy that has led to low inflation, a trend toward economic deregulation, trade liberalization, all of those things, support for and protection for intellectual property, the Bayh-Dole Act of 1980 that revolutionized the transition of new ideas and new knowledge into industrial applications, have all had an effect. And these are indirect public policy issues that have had a profound effect on our research environment. Now, it's reasonable and important to ask whether our national policies could create some change in the first part of the new millennium. I think that we can see some indication of progress, but some of danger in the last Congress. 3 weeks ago, about, the Congress finally completed its work on the fiscal year 2000 budget, almost 2 months into the new fiscal year. You heard about it this morning, midnight appropriations bill and the like. One of the issues that I personally, with a few other college and university presidents, have lobbied on for 25 years is making the research and development tax credit a permanent part of the tax code. It has been a part of the tax code, renewed every 3 years or so, which is good. I don't want them to stop doing that. But the problem with it is that industry, unless it can write down the investment in these 3 years or 5 years or whatever, feels at risk if they make a large investment and depend on that write down. So they can only make small ones on that score. We have been through all the issue of abuse. We've been through all the issues of corporate welfare. It is neither. It is progressive in progress. And you heard, I was pleased to hear Congressman Ehlers say this morning that he supported this measure. We almost got it done, but we didn't get it done again. They now have extended it for only 5 years. So I would encourage all of you, as members of the university community, just as I encourage my corporate colleagues, to get involved in this issue politically. It was the genius of Dale Corson and his colleagues to establish the Government University Industry Research Roundtable, to have a venue in which these matters could be discussed. I believe we have made good progress. I believe there is much left to do. We hope that we can continue to make progress in what is indeed an interconnected world. Thank you very much.